Different memories. It was basic training at Fort Knox. So, I love the landscape, including the. They've got three hills there where you're legally not supposed to send trainees through, but they do anyway. They're called the hills are agony, misery, and despair. But it gets you in shape. I wanted also to thank everybody who put this together and invited me and the other historians. It's been a lot of fun, and I know you all hear this and know this, but to come to a historical society, an organization like this, that's so well embraced by the community and has active participants, it's a lot rarer than you might think. So this is wonderful. I'm going to be speaking, as Tori mentioned, from 1965 to the present, so I'm sure nobody here has any opinions about that period, but we'll get started. I've got a couple maps to start off, and this is around 2005 to give you net migrations worldwide. So the U.S., as we'll get into numbers in a little bit, it does show U.S. and Canada. The primary numbers are U.S., although Canada gets a significant migration from Asia. Interesting, the only real gaining countries except for continents, Australia, North America, not including Mexico, and the African migration to Italy and Southern Europe. And this is contemporary. And to give you an idea also from there, this, I know some of the color coding is hard to see, but countries by in net in migration and net out migration. This was published in 2005 by a textbook company. And this is a percentage, per 1,000 population, 3% and above. Only a handful of countries, Canada and the U.S., Australia, one South American country, two African countries, and no European countries. And then there is, my geography is going to get me in trouble here. Any guesses? Sorry. That would make sense in the sense that it's after the takedown of the Taliban and a lot of migration back. And then the net out migrations, the big ones are obviously Central America that we think of today. Central America, parts of South America, Asia, several former Soviet Union countries, and Greenland for some reason. But it's a percentage here, so the numbers obviously are much smaller for Greenland than for everywhere else. One of the big questions about migration is how do you get a green card? And this is one of the things I'm going to go through. How do you get permanent residency? And I'll come back to this at the very end, but the idea of coming in, regardless of what your status is, to get a green card, legal permanent residency, it's a maze. And I think we've already heard that. I mean, going all the way back, it was a little easier in the 1880s. But especially post 1921 and 1924, gets a little more complicated once they start setting up a system that, at least on paper, is a workable system. And my focus is we start in 1965 because of, again, as Tori mentioned, the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965, and we see what it does. There are two. Now, you've seen these charts in different ways. Dorothy had it, and so did Tori, these numbers. Roughly, this is 1900 to 2010. And if you look at the bottom, or the solid, is the real numbers in the millions. But the percentages are the percentage of the total population. So the immigration to the U.S. in 2010 is still less per capita than it was in 1910. So, you know, keeping that in mind, that the country, it's still the 1900 to 1910 is probably it's the biggest boom of the 20th and 21st century. These are out of order. I'm sorry. I'm gonna leave it right here for a second. The 1965 Act, and I'm going to go through several acts, sort of get you from 1965 to the present. And I like to walk around, so let me know if you can't hear me. There's a handful of legislation, national legislation from 65 to 2005 that I'll talk about, and then I want to wrap up by talking about the wave starting with Arizona of state immigration laws or anti-immigration laws. Probably better said. And being in Alabama, I've got a little bit of experience with that. And I was there. I've been there for 6 years, so I've got that little bit of that idea of at least what was going on in that area. Immigration policies, as you've probably gone throughout the day, there are several driving factors with immigration policy. It's partially shaped, obviously, by the need for labor. And that's a lot of these exceptions to the rules happen because of the need for labor. It's also shaped by xenophobia, mentioned earlier, or primarily the fear of losing your job to a foreigner. The third is foreign policy. Again, as Tori just mentioned, if you're in a communist country during the Cold War or a non-ally of the U.S., chances are a lot slimmer of you being able to get in than if you were for If you are in a communist country, it's easier to get in through the refugee status because it makes the U.S. look good to bring in these folks from American enemies. But if you were in an ally country like Guatemala or several African countries, then it was almost impossible to get refugee become a refugee in the U.S. So it's the Cold War policy, general foreign policy, xenophobia, and the need for labor shapes everything. 1965 comes along, and I'm going to just highlight some of the things that Tori said to put my talk in perspective, and then add to that. 65 is, if you take your, you know, going back to 1965, what's happening? What just happened in 64? It's the Civil Rights. You have the Civil Rights Act of 1964. You have the Civil Rights of 65. And this act, the Hart-Sellers Act, which is a 65 act, is signed on the island, the Statue of Liberty. And remember the name of the island. Anybody? Sorry? Ward's Island. It's very symbolic, and this is the driving motivation behind that in Washington is civil rights. It's about getting rid of the national origins quotas. Remember, the 24 quotas are based on early census figures that favor primarily Western European or quote-unquote white countries, and make it almost impossible for Asians and Africans to get in the country. It also established the limitations of visas allotted each year. With the one exception, there are no limits on visas for family reunification. The congressman this morning mentioned that in these quotas for green cards, there's an overall number, and that's been met. It was met a couple months ago for this year in April. That gives you an idea of the number. And again, there's an exception to everything. That doesn't mean that there are no more immigrants coming in, not only for family reunification, but refugees as a way to become a parolee, as was mentioned earlier. And it's all about sponsorship. You know, if there's a Silicon Valley company that really, really needs somebody, they'll eventually get them despite the numbers. But 65 is important because if you think about today's national immigration crisis, as it's called in the news, it didn't just happen. It's a direct result of poorly conceived immigration laws for the last 50, 60 years, which the laws are directly responsible for this large number of undocumented immigrants. And the problem with immigration right now, the public debate is about undocumented immigrants in the U.S. Before 1965, there were, in 1950, there were 450,000, in the 50s, 450,000 Mexicans that entered the U.S. each year as a bracero, and another 50,000 as permanent residents. Remember, they were not under any quota, any limitation. With this law that even the table or got rid of these biases, it gave every country a limit of 20,000 visas or green cards. Putting family reunification aside. So from one year to the next, you have, and the Bracero program had just ended also. So, 3 years before 65, you have roughly 500,000 Mexicans coming to work in the U.S. These are people with jobs. In 2 years, it goes from 500,000 to 20,000. The jobs hadn't disappeared. There hadn't been a big influx of labor to take these jobs. So 65 really is the beginning of what we think of today, surge of undocumented immigrants from Mexico. Before that, there really wasn't. You could be undocumented at certain times in history, if you couldn't pass a literacy test, if you had some illness, if you didn't answer one of the questions right. But along the Mexican-U.S. border, primarily Arizona, Texas, and California, where the jobs were, if you came to the border, you were just let through because local business really needed them, agribusiness really needed them. So the Border Patrol worked with local business in that case, and that was the truth. Probably to 65 and a couple years after, beyond 65, before they really started cracking down on the enforcement. The new criteria for admission under the 65 Act, the main benefit of that was the family reunification, and if you had scarce or occupational skills that were scarce in the U.S. that were needed. So think of today, computer scientists and in some sense entrepreneurs, as long as it's a scientific or an engineering degree. The new preference system allowed highly skilled professionals, primarily doctors, nurses, engineers from Asian countries, to immigrate and eventually sponsor their families to come in. And this is huge. There's really no significant Asian migration before 65. And again, certain times in history, it was illegal to come in. And even if you came in, there was no way you could become a citizen. Independently of the 1965 Immigration Act, immigrants from Latin America began to rise. Legal and undocumented migration from Mexico surged beginning in the 70s. In addition to the Mexican migration, beginning in the 70s, you have waves of Vietnamese, Cambodian, and Hmong refugees following the collapse of American support or American-supported regimes in Southeast Asia. And I know this area benefited from that migration or from that resettlement. Then in the 1980s, there were some new refugees, and I'll talk a little bit about what happens in the 1980 Act. And that 19, we go from 65 to 80, there's no real significant, there's no major legislation. In 1980 is the Refugee Act. Before 1980, it was to be a refugee. It was it fundamentally changes after 1980. The act signaled a longstanding commitment of principles of international human rights and refugee relief. It signals the beginning of the U.S.'s commitment to that publicly with the signing on or mirroring the U.N. Commission on Refugees, the U.N. Commission... yes, UNHDR, thank you. They had been around for a while, and this signals the U.S.'s acceptance of that. And this act, the immigration law and policy, the work it started under JFK and was passed in 1980 with the leadership of Ted Kennedy. It built upon the Immigration and Nationality Act of 65, and it added to the historic levels of immigration and refugees post-65. If we look at these numbers, 65, you really don't see a big bump until 80. But in 65, or in the 1960, 1970, numbers, even and percentages, go way down. In 1980, after they redefined what it means to be a refugee by adopting the international definition that had been the international definition since 1951, someone who is unable to return to his or her country because of, quote, a well-founded fear of persecution. Before, it had to do primarily with whether your country was communist or not, bottom line. It was foreign policy driven. So Cubans, again, I keep giving this example, it's the most straightforward. Cubans and Ethiopians eventually and other communist countries, if you were able to escape, you were able to come into the U.S. almost automatically. After that, it became possible for Guatemalans after 1980 for any country, as long as you were worried about a persecution based on race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a social group. That being said, if you're a membership in some anarchist group, you might still have issues getting in the country. But this did replace the ad hoc responses, because there were responses. Before 1980, these ad hoc responses to refugee crises with the Vietnamese primarily, the Southeast Asian populations, with the Cubans fleeing the Cuban Revolution or the end of the Cuban Revolution. That was all just, it was piecemeal, it was ad hoc. The other thing this did was authorize the granting refugee status to individuals who were already in the U.S. under the legal designation that was called political asylum. That term becomes pretty much, political asylum as an official government word goes away and it becomes refugee. It also provided resettlement assistance, both monetary and through support for sponsorships. The newly arrived refugees were helped to rebuild and start anew. And again, this area, as we talk about this area of Kentucky and of the country benefited from these resettlements. As soon as that passes, there's a little bit of a problem. Remember this whole Cuba, if you're Cuban, if you can get here, you get political asylum because you're escaping Castro. A few months after the passage of this bill, you have the Mariel boat lift, where 125,000 asylum seekers end up on Florida shores. And that was something that the U.S. was not prepared for. Before 1980, only those already approved for admission from abroad were eligible to come as refugees. After that, you didn't have to apply overseas. You could get on the shores and ask for asylum or refugee status. I assume most everybody here is familiar with the Mariel Boat Lift and the Marielitos, as they're called. They were a group that, I just showed my class. I'm teaching a drug war through film class, and you just saw Scarface. So if you remember the beginning of Scarface, that was a big dramatization. I wouldn't call it historically accurate, but it was a big dramatization of that wave of folks that came in, how many of them were in prisons for violent offenses or in mental institutions and under either treatment or isolation that are just as a money-saving move and as a headache-saving move, I guess, by Castro. He just puts everybody on boats but doesn't let anybody bring any papers. So the U.S. has absolutely no idea who's who. After the Mario Boat List, there's a successive wave of asylum seekers from Central American countries who are right in the middle of the long-running, well, in the middle of civil wars, Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua. At that point, theoretically, if you're a Salvadoran and you ask for refugee status, you would get it. That, of course, assumes that there were no politics behind it. The U.S. response was initially underfunded and fragmented. In the early 1990s, the U.S. redesigned the asylum process and established a new system that has proven to be a little more responsive and more timely and responsive, as well as at least more of an appearance of fairness and impartiality. And this is with the immigration judges and the system that, again, came up this morning. As a result, since the 80s, the U.S. now grants political asylum, refugee status, to people from more than 105 countries each year. After the 1980 Act, so this is where you start getting the wave of refugees in 1980. In 1990, the Immigration Act of 1990 was somewhat of a response. Everything's a response to 65 or something that happened after that. 65 is still the framework. Let me back up. 1986. I missed one. Some of you might remember the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986. That was big for, I guess the derogatory term was, it provided a path to legal status and citizenship for the first time. It was a response to the fear that was created by a published report called 12 Million Illegal Immigrants. This act had three parts to it: legalization, eventual legalization of these undocumented immigrants, and this is primarily Mexican, almost entirely Mexican. First time there's employer sanctions. Whether they're enforced even today, that's a back and forth. But before 1986, there were no official employer sanctions, no codified employer sanctions for hiring somebody who did not have legal status in the U.S. It also provided a new category of temporary replacement worker. This is when the temporary workers, the HB... primarily the HB3, speaking of Jamaican workers, also some other temporary skilled workers, it provided a new way in. But this was meant primarily for agriculture workers. If you think of today, this is still very important for areas in the southeast and in the northeast. I think I lived in Burlington, Vermont for a year, and they still have Jamaicans come up to pick apples every season. And it's the same folks at work come in, pick apples, go home, come back every harvest season. Of these three reform parts, and against reform in 65, the first one worked well, the legalization. It did what it was meant to do, and that was if you could prove you had been in the country, I believe it was 82, you had proving by having people who were citizens who employed you, you know, priests and pastors. There's a lot of paperwork to do. You had to have people willing to say, yeah, I hired this person. And if all the paperwork went in, this vast majority of folks got a green card. Whether they got citizenship, that was a longer process, but they became legal. The employer sanctions, again, as I mentioned, are rarely enforced, even today. Every once in a while, if it's an extreme case, like the meatpackers in Iowa, and there's a meatpacking case in Mississippi also, but it's very rare that that employers get fined. And the replacement agricultural labor, the program as it was originally designed was never implemented. So that's, you know, that's something that just, it never came about. And in the 86, again, it allowed fines and prison sentences for employers who hired undocumented immigrants. It further restricted immigration from Mexico and Latin American countries. The idea was that, okay, we're going to legalize people in the U.S. And you hear a lot of this rhetoric, a lot of this discussion today. What's the best way to legalize folks, or depending on what your views are, either legalize folks or have them, I guess the language today is self-deport, have them leave. One of the things that this act did was contributed to the discrimination of both documented and undocumented immigrants. We were talking earlier about Mexicans. The one difference with Mexicans, and talk about how Europeans could become white. There's several works out there. The Irish were treated less than white, but they would eventually become, like the Italians and the Germans, seen as full U.S. citizens. Mexicans, though, you have in the Southwest, third, fourth, fifth generation Mexican-Americans. And if you live in Arizona today or Phoenix, chances are just as likely, depending on how you're dressing and your skill level, that you'll get pulled over and have to prove your status, have to prove the fact that you've lived here. So this, because people, employers primarily, this is where, now that it becomes the employer can get in trouble, they're going to be more careful, and they're going to err on the side of caution. So if somebody comes up that looks Mexican, looks foreign, I think that's the Arizona term. I don't want the headache. Let's not bother. We're just not going to hire anybody that might have the remotest chance. So this is where you get the discrimination that builds, actually starting in 86, and you see some of that that's come again today. All right, now 1990. 1990 established a worldwide ceiling of immigrants at 675,000. It's flexible in the sense that the immediate relatives of U.S. citizens are included under the quota cap, but their numbers are unlimited. So they could take up a spot, but once those spots run out, they would not stop families. And at the end, I'm going to show you this really cool chart that explains the process, or the hypocrisy of the process, I should say, but it's there. Family-based immigration is guaranteed at least 226,000 visas. Employment-based preferences are allotted 140,000 visas, but it had to be less than 7% of the total number from any single country. So it changes at 20,000 a year for every country, but it still has pretty low limits. And employment-based diversity immigrants are allocated 40,000 visas each year. They are aliens born in countries adversely affected by the 1965 law and their spouses and children, so primarily Latin American countries and Canada, for that sort of thing. It's primarily Latin American countries that get affected adversely by that 65 law. And with 96, then you go to 1996, I know I'm moving forward through all of this, but they all sort of add to what we think of today as immigration. 1986 actually makes, 96 makes 86, adds to 86 and makes it more severe. It provides for expedited removal, which is big today. Expedited, the idea was that if you got picked up, you went, there was a process to get deported. But in several cases, it is expedited, meaning that, you know, theoretically you either waive your rights or you fit under several categories and there is no judicial process. You know, there's no even immigration court process. You're deported. People guilty of only technical lapses, meaning that their visa ran out or that they missed a deadline, or can be let off in handcuffs and jailed. And the law made it harder for refugees from Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Guatemala to become citizens. Again, that goes back to Mexicans. The U.S. has this love-hate relationship throughout the country with Mexicans because they are the leading group since 1848 to work on the land that became the U.S. post-1848. You know, these are, the economy in Mexico has never been in great shape, and the Mexican economy is actually dependent on, today, on remittances. So it's something, and I remember the latest numbers, it's something like a fourth, maybe a third of the U.S., of the Mexican economy is based on money coming back from American workers, from workers in the America, in the U.S. The reentry policy part of 1996 imposed a 10-year bar on reentry. So if you had a tourist visa, and if you live along the border, it's a permanent tourist visa you have. It's not a green card, but you have permission. As long as you don't live in the U.S., you can pretty much go back and forth in unlimited. But you know, if they notice at the border that you're doing a reverse commute, in other words, you're going to work in Mexico and living in the U.S., and you get caught, you can't apply to get that visa or any kind of reentry again for 10 years. And if you leave the country, if you're in a process of gaining legal status and you leave the country, you're barred for 10 years. The act also required sponsors to earn sponsors, in other words, a family member that's sponsoring a child or a spouse to come in. They had to earn 125% of the poverty level. And this 1996 act allowed immigrants to be deported for even minor infractions of the law, and that's something that post 9/11, really, you hear about all the time. If somebody ends up getting jailed for a misdemeanor, immigration finds out, and if that's a priority at the time, again, with all the politics, legally, you can get deported. You lose your green card and get deported for a minor infraction. And that was meant primarily for violent felonies, but that's been used for pretty much any infraction of the law. The benefits for legal immigrants of the 96, it wasn't all negative. The personal responsibility, well, let me rephrase that. The benefits, meaning the benefits that legal immigrants, if you had a green card and you worked, I grew up in South Texas in Laredo on the border, it's about 95-96% of Mexican descent. Of those, probably 50-60% of the folks are permanent legal residents, green cards. They immigrated and they worked. Again, you were here legally. You had a Social Security card. You played by the rules. You put it into Social Security. You put it into Medicare. Again, something that the Congress mentioned this morning. And then with 96, it cut off all SSI. It cut off all those benefits if you were not a citizen. So you could have actually worked and paid taxes for 40 years, retired, and as long as if you never naturalized, then then that got blocked. So about 800,000 legal immigrants who received SSI lost most of their benefits. And it also cut off food stamps for legal immigrants. Again, you're talking about folks that are here, permission that have been were working at some point. And again, where I grew up, there was no, and in a lot of places, especially for Mexicans, if you're in a community like South Chicago or South Texas, citizenship really didn't make a difference. I mean, voting, that was about it. But if you're in a place, you're going to get harassed. You're going to get harassed whether you have citizenship or not. You know, is it worth the money and the time to get citizenship? There was no real big motivation. So there are a lot of people that lived their whole lives, you know, 50, 60 years, and legally with a green card, that lose their benefits overnight in 96. In 97, Congress corrects some of that, and food stamps and benefits were restored for some immigrants, but not all of them. I'm rushing through. We're now in the 21st century. From 96, everything is there are the complaints, but in 5 years between 96 and 9/11, there's nothing really major going on as far as immigration. There's a lot of immigrants coming in, but the economy, for the most part, is doing pretty well in most places. Then you have 9/11, and immigration becomes about immigration control. Border control becomes about controlling terrorists. In the wake of 9/11, you know, again, Homeland Security takes over customs and immigration, and I think immediately they were called ICE. You know, that's a nice welcoming acronym, ICE. I think they've changed. They finally changed it. I don't remember what it is now, but it's. I'm sorry. It's well. There's a part of ICE in Homeland Security that they're not using that acronym anymore. They found one. I'm sorry. Right, it's a Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement now, so Bureau of, yeah, BICE. it's not as cold. I'm sorry? You know, you figure somebody would figure that out. There's enough PR people employed by the government. With the Department of Homeland Security, with them taking over most of the INS functions, including the Border Patrol, Customs, Immigration. Policies put in, with a few exceptions, policies that were put into place in 1965 are the same ones governing the U.S. at this point. I mentioned the very few exceptions. Non-citizens currently in the U.S. lawfully in one non-citizens are in the U.S. lawfully one of two ways, and that is either receiving a temporary non-immigrant visa, tourist visa, or a student visa, and that's a student one becomes a big target, was analyzed critically because its involvement with the events of 9/11, or the fact that a lot of them had overstayed a student visa. So you could be legal if you have a temporary or if you have a green card or a permanent admission. A member of the green card category is classified as a lawful permanent resident. And they have full permission to work. And if you have a green card, the assumption is that you can eventually become a citizen one way or the other. To give you some numbers that happened after 9/11, and 10 years after 9/11, the share of working age immigrants, officially 18 to 65, holding a job was the same as native born, 68%. Immigrant men have a higher rate of work than native born men, while immigrant women have a lower rate. And here, one thing, while immigrants tend to be concentrated in certain jobs, and we think of immigrant jobs, you know, the agriculture, maids, janitors, every occupation in the U.S. nationwide is dominated by non-immigrants. For example, natives comprise 52% of maids, 73% of janitors, 66% of construction workers, and 65% of those in meatpacking. More than one quarter of physicians and surgeons are foreign-born. One out of every five people who work in healthcare, including nursing, psychiatry, home health aides, are foreign-born. So it's they're large, significant part of the skill set, but most people, well, you know, when you think of an unwanted immigrant, it's very much race and skill based. You know, you have the skill positions that most people do not complain about daily, unless you're an engineer who doesn't have a job, and then you blame immigrants. Sorry, I lost the clicker. There are a couple of exceptions. How many of y'all have seen this picture? How many of y'all have heard of Jose Antonio Vargas? Jose Antonio Vargas is a Washington Post reporter who won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the Virginia Tech shootings. He actually outed himself as not here legally. He was brought into the U.S. to live with his grandparents from the Philippines when he was 5 or 6. And had no idea he was undocumented until he applied for financial aid and it was rejected for college. And this is a case for many of who we call the Dreamers today. So the Dream Act, something else that came up this morning, is a special category, and it's a bit of a catch-22. The critics say, you know, again, what part of illegal don't you understand? They don't have status here. Most Dreamers are high school graduates. The person who is, the person right here was valedictorian of his class in Birmingham, Alabama, and realized his senior year that he wouldn't be able to go to college legally. Alabama, it is illegal for an undocumented person to go to community college or to college. And the debate about the Dream Act was, how do you get from where they are, depending on the state you are, a lot of these folks are college graduates looking for their first job and then can't get a job because they can't prove legal status in the U.S. Skilled people who have been in the U.S. since a very early age. And the number is altogether, not only them, but altogether today there are 12 million, an estimated 12 million undocumented immigrants. And the vast majority of those are folks who are being productive members of society. And I bring up Alabama, and I bring this, that takes me to the last point, and that's what's been in the news the last, what year are we in, 14? The last 3 years, or 2011, 2010, starting with Arizona. 1070 in Arizona, and Alabama was HB 56. These are the state laws that were approved by the state. It's in red here because these are partially or completely blocked by federal court action. But the red and the green together are all states who had introduced legislation, anti-immigration legislation. And again, I know the South is a very big states' rights community that goes back today. The rhetoric is sometimes really interesting historically today. Today, what they're saying today, very few people have the historical memory of the rhetoric. The big movement in Alabama against this law brought in a lot of civil rights activists and some organizations from outside the state. And the head of the Mobile Republican Women's Club was quoted, and she's not a native Alabaman, she's from Thousand Oaks, California. She was quoted as saying, "Oh, these are just outside agitators." Yeah, without realizing what kind of loaded language that is in Alabama. But these states, the ones in red, all passed it. I've only been in Alabama 6 years, but there's two things I learned really quickly. One is, always hate Auburn. I've been in Tuscaloosa, so always hate Auburn. And two, thank God for Mississippi. Because the state of Alabama, it's gotten a little better, but historically, the state of Alabama is usually 49th in all the good things and second in all the bad things because of Mississippi. Except in this case, Mississippi actually introduced an anti-immigration law, but it was defeated in the legislature. So these are, I guess this flowchart, the granddaddy is Arizona. A lot of the laws, all of these laws are actually based on on the law in Arizona, and a lot of them are actually written identically because of an organization called ALEC that I can get into if anybody has a question with later. But when Alabama passed that law, it had a lot of provisions that Arizona had already been blocked in Arizona. But the argument with the legislature there was that, let's just do what you want and let the courts, we'll fix it if the courts tell us we can't do that. This was in 2011. The state hadn't recovered. Not only hadn't recovered, but just had the 2011 tornadoes that cost the state a lot of money and lives. But the state has just settled with the Southern Poverty Law Center for $580,000 in legal fees because of the lawsuits based on the law. The one thing, I want to point out Alabama as an example because I'm most familiar with it, and a lot of it, you've heard of it, a lot of the Arizona stuff, and the other states are not as, when Alabama passed it, they boasted in the legislature and the governor that we had the toughest immigration law. Again, despite the fact that immigration is technically a federal issue, you don't want to get too nitpicky, I guess. But this is what the law did. Basically, you had to show proof of legal status, is what they called it. If you went to pay your property taxes, you have to have a permit to have a trailer home. Any interaction with the state, meaning the county, any government, you had to have legal status, prove your legal status. And if one of the big penalties with this law was that you would get the state employee or the local employee, the state bureaucrat, this county bureaucrat, could get fined or jailed if they conducted business with an undocumented person. We go back to the whole why risk it, If they look Mexican, why risk it? I'm going to err on the side of caution. So in some cities, library cards were denied. In others, water, being able to connect water and sewer. If you think about the U.S.'s policy with developing countries and the human right of having access to drinking water, that was an issue. These were all blocked by the court eventually, but were active. If you were in a car, you had to prove you were in there legally, not only if you were a driver, but if you were a passenger. The most famous, and the only way to do that without racial profiling is asking every single person for proof. How many of you all ever leave the home if you're walking somewhere without your driver's license or passport, for that matter, any kind of official legal presence document? In Alabama, you have to be legal to get a driver's license, so that's one of the measures. in Tuscaloosa County, the police chief, who was very much against this law, did it the only way you could do it, and that's just across the board, ask everybody. And I think in the first few months, the arrests were 30% Latino, 40% white, and 30% African American. I think the numbers are right. If you walk in a convenience store and got stopped, the police had the right to ask you for proof that you were here legally. The most famous stop was right outside of Tuscaloosa, Mercedes-Benz makes their SUVs and a couple of other classes of sedans. And a senior vice president of Mercedes from Stuttgart was driving from Birmingham, from the manufacturer, which is about 7 miles out of town, to town, and gets pulled over because his rental car doesn't have a license plate. Not his fault. The rental company gave him a car with a license plate. He gets asked for ID. He gives him an international driver's license, which is not recognized by the state of Alabama as an official form. And it doesn't show any proof of legal presence. So the law says if they don't, they have to be booked. And they have to go in, be booked, and then put in detention until somebody can come and give them the papers. So before he went between the time of the stop and the time of the booking, the governor already knew about it. Who happens to be a Tuscaloosan, but there were some repercussions there. And then a few weeks later, a Hyundai executive in southern Alabama gets pulled over too and jailed. But that was the only way to do it without, you know, if you're going to do it without racial profiling, which the legislature said was possible, you had to do that. Public elementary schools had the right to ask or had to ask any new admissions for their parents' legal status. That, as you can imagine, is a big deterrent for students to even go to school. So the public schools lost something like a third of immigrants, a third to a half of immigrants didn't show up the day after the law went into effect. And a lot of them left the state. Others, parents didn't want to send their kids because if they went to go pick them up, they were worried about getting picked up. And that actually happened in some cities. So it's the biggest thing, and then I'll wrap it up here. The biggest thing that never got blocked by the courts but is now blocked is the legal contract. There's a provision that any contract signed by an undocumented immigrant, somebody without legal presence, is void and null automatically. That means if you bought a car, they could come pick it up. If you had a mortgage, they could take your house back. Again, it's between federal and state. Obviously, federal banks would have more of an issue. If you had a contract with a lawyer, theoretically, everything was null. And that took a full appeals court decision to block that. Long story short, Alabama, about a month ago, agreed, settled with the Southern Poverty Law Center and all those litigants to keep permanently blocked every part of the law that the court had blocked temporarily and settle the lawsuit. But of course, you won't see this in the news because there was no press release. The Southern Poverty Law Center issued a press release, but the government did not. I'm short on time, so I wanted to show you this. What part of illegal don't you understand? Again, in most of these states, when you're having this, it's like, it's a no-brainer. What part of illegal don't you understand? They should get in line. This is what the line looks like. And I go through, this is close up, I go through the whole thing in a second. If you come into the U.S., if you have family in the U.S., and your relative is a U.S. citizen, are you that relative's parent, spouse, or minor children? No. If you're an adult sibling, a U.S. citizen, you can apply for a green card, and it depends on how many years. I'm going to move this over. It goes on. If you are a parent, sibling, or child, a minor child, parent, or spouse, that's the easiest way. There's no annual cap, as I mentioned earlier, and you can get green card pretty quickly. And after five years, if you leave your spouse, you're eligible to become a citizen. It takes about 6 to 12 months to get your papers in. And best case scenario, this is if you're a family member, is 6 to 7 years for citizenship. If you have a family member but they're not one of those three, are you a single adult child, 6 to 14 year wait for a green card. If you're a married adult child, 7 to 15 year wait for a green card. If you're a sibling of a citizen, 11 to 22 years. And then once you get your green card, it will take you 6 years to become a citizen, which gives you 12 to 28 year waiting period. If you have family in the U.S., but they're not a U.S. citizen or lawful permanent resident, in other words, they're undocumented. I'm sorry. Here they're a citizen. Here they've got a green card. If you're the spouse, keep going. If you're not one of those three, sorry, there's no way you can come in legally. If you're a minor child, spouse and minor children of lawful permanent residents can apply. Depends on your home country. With the green card, you're talking about 11 to 13 years. If you're not, you're out of luck. If you are married, you're out of luck. If you're single, then you have wait times that mean 14 to 20 years. This is the legal line. And if you don't have family in the U.S., are you skilled? No, forget it. You're not coming in. There's virtually no process for unskilled immigrants without relations in the U.S. to apply for permanent legal residency. Only 10,000 cards are allotted every year, and the wait time approaches infinity. And these are H-2A and H-2B visas that we were talking about earlier. The seasonal workers cannot convert those to green cards. So you have a skill. Can you prove that you're a genius or athlete, a star athlete, or an investor with over $1 million? Think of Robert Murdoch. Congratulations, you found the quickest way to green card, taking 12 to 18 months. But you would have made it anywhere, Mr. Beckham. An example, I think, in this spot, is the highly skilled are college professors, scientists, engineers. So you're skilled, do you have a college degree in a specialty occupation? Okay, then you have a shot. Do you have a job offer? No, you're out of luck. If you do have a job offer, is your employer willing to pay about $10,000? The wait time is 6 to 10 years, and then you're looking at 11 to 16 years to citizenship. If they don't want to pay, you're out of luck. If your employer can't wait 6 to 10 years for you to start work, is he really willing to apply for an H-1B visa, which is the professional one? Then you have a 50-50 chance because of the numbers, $85,000 a year. And if he's not willing to apply for that, you're out of luck. So these are sort of the age, again, the 10 to 13 years, 14 to 20 years, 11 to 16 years. And the quickest way is getting in the U.S. within a year. It could be a lot quicker if you're Cuban and got drafted by a baseball team, but you're still looking at 6 to 7 years to citizenship. And this, again, very American thing, the idea is that the goal is citizenship. And for a lot of these workers, it's about making money, improving life, and sending money back to family that didn't come, and citizenship is secondary, and they feel that they can be an asset to the U.S. without having citizenship. Thank you very much. I can take questions. My class has a lot of fun with these. Questions? Yes. To get in line, you have to leave. And so you have to be willing to leave and then wait years to get back in. Yes. unless there's an amnesty, and that's where the amnesty comes in. The amnesty legislation. That's the only way you're going to convert those folks to legal status, right?
$125%
of poverty. And again, most of these immigrants that are working class immigrants are going to be right on the fence. If they're here by themselves, you know, one person by themselves, the poverty level is significantly higher than it is if you already have your family here. Any questions?
We have one more question.
No? Wow, Tori, you jinxed it. Thank you. Thank you.